Why Miami-Dade kicked the incinerator can down the road, why arrests of homeless residents are skyrocketing, and why Tua Tagovailoa may need to quit football. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll look at the Miami-Dade County Commission's decision to delay its vote on a new $1.5 billion waste incinerator so it can find a site where it's actually welcome. We'll also discuss how a new state law has led to a sudden and controversial spike in the arrests of people experiencing homelessness. And like many football fans, we'll ask if Dolphins quarterback Tua Tagovailoa's concussion crisis means he should leave the sport and how unsafe that sport is. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo. Just a reminder, you can make your donation to continue to support programs like this by calling 866-247-9576 or go to WLRN.org. It's been almost 2 years since Miami-Dade County's major waste incinerator burned down in Doral. The loss of the facility, also known as a waste energy plant, created waste management panic because it processed half the trash in a county that has run out of landfill space. Doral residents say they didn't want a replacement incinerator built in their community now, so Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava and the County Commission have had to look for an acceptable alternative site. It hasn't been easy. The location preferred by Levine-Cava, an old airfield in the county's northwest corner, has met with protest from nearby communities like Miramar in Broward County. But the option that seemed to intrigue county commissioners most at their meeting this week is an old quarry in the small town of Medley. Either way, the commission delayed its vote on the matter until November. Meanwhile, environmental groups are urging the county to scrap trash incineration altogether for cleaner methods. Here are some of your voices weighing in earlier this week at a town hall on the incinerator issue in Doral.
Miami is committed to move towards a zero waste future. How do we ensure that the incinerator will remain viable?
What specific policies are we going to start to put in place in Miami-Dade to reduce waste and to get down to zero waste?
Is it possible that we could be throwing out taxpayer money if the EPA emission standards shut down incinerators throughout the country?
Joining me now to help us understand why this project has faced so much community resistance across South Florida is the mayor of Miramar, Wayne Messam. Mayor Messam, thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
I want to first get to your take on the incinerator site proposal you have strongly opposed, the almost 500-acre Airport West location up there in northwest Miami-Dade that you believe would adversely affect the quality of life in your city next door, Miramar, in Broward County. Do you believe, Mayor, that the Miami-Dade County Commission's decision to delay its vote signifies that they've now decided against the county-owned Airport West parcel?
Well, it's not decided until it's actually decided.
Sure, yeah.
The city of Miramar feels that, you know, this is a threat to anyone's community. We don't want incineration in anyone's neighborhood. And we also know the Airport West site is the most fragile and sensitive options that have been brought forward, sitting right in our back door, and we oppose it for many reasons.
Fragile why? Why that works?
It's fragile because it sits right on the lip of the Everglades. The Everglades starts off the shores of Lake Okeechobee down to Florida Bay and not a visitor center as cited by the mayor. Also, Airport West sites, it abuts the C9 impoundment area. You know, it's over $1 billion investment by the federal and state governments to ensure that South Florida actually have a supply of clean water.
Okay.
Incinerators require a landfill. So that will mean a perpetual management and storage of toxic ash that basically sits next to this clean, pristine water. It's like you're having a cigar ash and you're pouring it into a clean glass of water.
Okay.
Why
so,
would we threaten South Florida's
so
water
what,
supply?
So what was your reaction when the owner of the old quarry in Medley that I mentioned, a gentleman named Lowell Dunn, What was your reaction when he proposed to sell that land to the commission for the incinerator site? Does that appear to be a more palatable option for you in Miramar and other communities?
Well, what it does is it gives Miami-Dade County additional options to come up with a sustainable way of managing garbage. And if sites are available, this will make it more optimal for Miami-Dade to pick the best site to do that. But we just know that Airport West is not, it simply is not a permittable site.
Okay. So, Mayor Messam, since Miramar is not the only municipality that in that slice of South Florida up there that doesn't want the incinerator in its backyard, and I'm, of course, also referring to Doral, which has decided it does not want an incinerator anymore, walk us through what you feel are the biggest negatives, be they environmental, economic, et cetera, for communities like yours.
Well, the fact of the matter is that when incineration technology is not a safe technology, it has been dubbed as safe, but it emits PFAS. Incineration technology doesn't completely destroy these forever chemicals, which are toxic to us all. The EPA is actually releasing new standards and managing them. So that is why it scares us. It threatens our human health. It threatens our water supply. And that is why incineration should not be the first choice.
But Miami-Dade County does seem pretty committed to this, and it appears pretty determined to build the new incinerator. Given that, what in the end do you feel would be a good site for it, short of pushing the development boundary with the Everglades back, which, you know, I don't think a lot of people find that palatable either? What's the solution here in terms of a site?
Well, the mayor has offered a master plan study to look at zero waste. And zero waste doesn't mean that you have no garbage. It just means that you're going to work to reduce the stream so that incineration is not required. And this needs to be studied. It needs to be explored. And if you're going to invest over $1.5 billion, once you build an incinerator, you have to continue to feed it to make the economics work. So we welcome the Miami-Dade County actually doing that study and seeing how the stream can be reduced so that incineration won't be necessary, and that's the solution.
But if incineration does turn out to be necessary, if they do go ahead with it, is there any site up in that area of Miami-Dade, Broward County, et cetera, in that slice of Miami, is there any site that you think could actually be acceptable if they have to go through with this?
Well, again, like I said, Miramar, we would not accept an incinerator. However, we do know that Airport West is not permittable. There would just be insurmountable federal and state permitting and regulatory challenges that a permit would not be achieved in our lifetime.
Right.
So as it relates to Airport West, we know that's not the right site. It's not Miramar's job to solve this for Miami-Dade County.
Sure.
We have not explored that. We just know that Airport West threatens our community, threatens the Everglades, it threatens our natural resources, and Miami-Dade County really needs to do it's the homework to make sure that it is managing solid waste in the best way that is environmentally sustainable and safe to human life as well as to the
right.
environment.
But let's go back to the issue, the larger issue as to why Miami-Dade County government perhaps feels that its back is up against the wall in terms of why it has to turn again to incineration. And I'm talking about the fact, as I mentioned at the outset, that we are running out of landfill space in South Florida, if we haven't already. Since the fire destroyed the incinerator in Doral last year, Miami-Dade has had to ship garbage to landfills and other facilities up north. But that can't go on indefinitely. So while we're trying to figure out ways to create or to achieve that zero waste goal that we keep talking about, if not an incinerator, and if not in Northwest Miami-Dade, then what and where, Mayor?
Well, like I said before, this problem has been solved around the world and the United States as it relates to non-incineration strategies to manage garbage. Miami-Dade County based their recommendation off a master study that did not adequately look at zero waste. It did not adequately look at all forms of disposing trash. It just took the most convenient and most expeditious route. It for the future of our communities, for the future and the sustainability for generations yet born at this nexus, Miami-Dade County owes it to its constituents, owes it to its neighbors to thoroughly investigate all options that we know has not done. We should not relent on just easy solutions that conveniently and politically allow lawmakers off the hook to ensure that we solve this problem.
So as we mentioned, you're in Broward, Miramar's in Broward. And so let me ask you then, tell us more about the waste situation in Broward itself and how it compares to Miami-Dade. What's different, not just about the garbage volume situation there, but perhaps how Broward is approaching its management of this situation compared to what you've just been describing in Miami-Dade?
Yeah, so Broward County has just established their own taxing authority and formed a solid waste authority. Governance has just been established, and the solid waste authority has commissioned a master plan that is doing exactly what I just stated. It will be exploring all forms and all types of technologies and strategies to manage waste. Once that report is done, then the recommendations will come from the study, and the city of Miramar has already been on record, as well as our neighbors in Pembroke Pines and Southwest Ranches, that we are against incineration. So I think the recommendations will be based off of a more thorough master plan study that will perhaps put Broward County in a better place to make a decision. Now, I have challenged Miami-Dade County to coordinate regionally with Broward, because with both counties, both looking at how it will manage waste, looking for the future, it just makes sense for both counties to assess their assets, to assess locations, and see where synergies exist so that we could perhaps have some of the solutions be achieved regionally.
Well, finally, then, Mayor, do you think the environmental groups, for example, have it right when they say that in lieu of incineration, we need to turn to things like recycling, compost? Do you think they have it right when they bring up alternatives to incineration?
Yes, I think they have it right. The issue is that governments have not thoroughly investigated ideas, and they have not thoroughly and cooperatively partnered with environmental stakeholders to see how innovation can help solve this issue. And I think I encourage not only Miami-Dade County, but Broward County to embrace some of these technologies so that we can begin to work with our constituents, because it's going to take a collective effort. It's going to take some behavior change. It's going to take some changes. But I think with the commitment to wanting to save and preserve our environment, that we all can achieve this. It is achievable.
And like one of the voices we heard in the town hall clip I just played, do you also worry that perhaps federal government regulations 9 or 10 years down the road, when we're thinking about completing this incinerary, could change to the point that incineration won't even be allowed anymore? Do you think Miami-Dade County is being mindful enough of that risk?
Well, not based off of the recommendations that Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava and staff continue to move forward. And that is why we are saying we need to start now. It's not that this is something that has to happen overnight, because once you reduce the stream of garbage, it can be managed between composting, between recycling, between all the other aspects of how we can responsibly dispose of our waste.
Okay, well, we'll have to leave it there, Mayor Messam. Thank you very much. Wayne Messam is the mayor of Miramar. Mayor Messam, many thanks. Still to come, why the sudden spike in arrests of homeless persons here? This is a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Just a reminder, you can make your donation to continue to support programs like this by calling 866-247-9576 or on WLRN.org. On October 1st, a new state law takes effect that makes it illegal to sleep or otherwise camp out in public spaces in Florida. The U.S. Supreme Court this summer gave laws like it the constitutional green light. But in Miami-Dade County, law enforcement has already begun arresting people experiencing homelessness in big numbers. So far this year, Miami Beach police have arrested more than 200 homeless persons who do not accept shelter. The city of Miami has seen a recent spike in arrests as well. In fact, so far this year, more people have been booked into jail in Miami-Dade County for so-called illegal public camping than in the previous 8 years combined, according to a WLRN analysis. And that has advocates for homeless persons scrambling to find or erect a lot more temporary or permanent housing. The county, in fact, just this week finalized a deal to turn a Cutler Bay hotel into units for 130 elderly homeless residents. Even so, the new laws and ordinances present a daunting new challenge. And few journalists here have been examining that challenge better than WLRN investigative reporter Danny Rivero, who joins me now in the studio. Danny, how are you?
Very good, Tim.
As you and I have discussed, this is actually more complicated than I made it sound in my introduction a second ago. To really understand what's going on, we have to go back even further than the state law that's going to go into effect on October 1st and this summer Supreme Court ruling, right? I mean, Walk us through what's been happening locally here in the past year or so that actually got this controversy rolling.
Right. I mean, there's a long history of anti-homeless measures. They're considered by a lot of local governments, a lot of residents, just generally nuisances, and there's been efforts across decades to try to get them out of the site. But in the more recent iteration, last September, Miami Beach passed an ordinance which allows the city to make arrests of homeless residents if they say that if the city says that they declined to be sheltered.
Right.
If they're choosing not to go into a shelter, which there are no shelters on Miami Beach,
right, exactly.
they would have to leave Miami Beach to go to a shelter.
Yeah.
But if they refuse it, they can now be arrested on a local small criminal charge. But yes, they can be arrested and, in fact, in some cases, booked into jail.
And the city of Miami also had an ordinance on the books, something similar, no?
It's a little more complicated in the city of Miami, but the city has been enforcing anti-homeless measures over the last several years. They're under a consent decree for decades that prevented them from making these kind of arrests or you know, just arresting people for what they called things that they just had to do to live and
that
survive.
Was known as the Pottinger.
The Pottinger agreement. So they're released from that and they've been making arrests as well.
How important then was the recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling to all of this?
You know, the recent Supreme Court ruling, it doesn't exactly play into the state law that went into effect, but it definitely gives a backstop on local laws like in Miami Beach, where it allows arrests for homelessness.
Yeah.
It basically said, okay, these things are generally okay.
Constitutionally,
they're
in terms of people's rights. Yeah.
Exactly.
Right. Now, what's interesting from your reporting, Danny, if not a little confusing, is the fact that Miami-Dade's leading homeless advocate actually spoke in favor of the new state law earlier this year as it was being debated in the Florida legislature. Why?
Right. So Ron Book is a very prominent and influential lobbyist in Tallahassee.
Head of the...
And he's also the head of the Miami-Dade Homeless Trust.
Right.
And he did speak in favor in the legislature of this measure. And he said the reason why is because he sees it as a way to finally solve the homelessness problem. The homeless population has been going down over the course of decades here in Miami-Dade, but we still have just over 1,000 homeless residents that they've been able to count. It has been on a downward trajectory. Mm-hmm. Ron Book said he supports this because it will give a push to build housing and finally get these people housed. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, now he's feeling the pressure of these looming deadlines and he told me he's extremely worried about it.
Right, so he felt that this would force local government's hands, perhaps, but now he's having some misgivings then.
Right, I mean, it's a case it's certainly a perspective that he has, and it's a very optimistic perspective.
Yeah,
where he's saying, you know, we're gonna have to make these decisions, and we're gonna do this, and we're gonna solve this problem, and you know.
But now, as he mentions,
he says like we're gonna do this on this day, and then it doesn't happen because there's political pressure,
right?
And people don't want to approve. You know, the purchase of this hotel in Cutler Bay, for example, a lot of the local residents and politicians don't want it. So there's a lot of right. back and forth. And as that back and forth happens, these deadlines are impending.
But now he fears that jails might become a substitute for homeless shelters if we keep this up.
Right. And he told me in principle that he's extremely against that. And, you know, and the reason is someone will get arrested for something. They'll get charged. They'll spend a day or two in jail. They'll probably get out with time served, and then they're right back on the street. And you just spent money to house them in jail for 2 days, and you didn't actually solve the problem.
But either way, the fact remains, as your reporting points out, that we are seeing a remarkable jump in the arrests of homeless persons here. Let's talk about the numbers that jump out at you and about the effects you're seeing that this having on the community.
Right. Well, as you mentioned, just so far this calendar year, there's been more bookings into jail of people for illegal camping than the previous 8 years combined. And most of those arrests happened right when Governor DeSantis signed his statewide law.
Right.
And you know, so it appears what's happening is that even before that's gone into effect, local governments are saying, hey, we need to solve this problem now. Let's start making some arrests under whatever ordinance we can do and whatever state law we can do, because we know that this is coming into effect. Mm-hmm. But it hasn't come into effect. But the jump is dramatic in the amount of jail bookings.
Obviously. What are homeless persons themselves telling you about this new reality, and more important, how it affects their ability to escape homelessness?
You know, we have talked to several homeless residents. You know, many of them have declined to actually go on the record and be reported.
Oh, sure.
But and I respect that, of course.
Of course.
But you know, an issue with, especially on the beach, there's this thing: you have to go to shelter or we will arrest you. An issue that people take with that is being in a shelter day in, day out is actually a kind of a full-time job in itself. Mm-hmm. You know, they lock the door at certain time. If you are working, you might get out of work too late to get into the shelter.
Yeah.
You have to stand in lines for hours, possibly every day
shelter.
To be a regular, it's a cycle.
I used to be a regular volunteer at the Chapman homeless shelter in South Dade, and I saw those problems.
It's hard.
Yeah,
it's hard to be in there. And when the government's telling you do this or else, well, you're really dictating every hour of someone's life.
But another really important issue you bring out in your report is that local governments could be facing costly litigation as a result of this new state law. The fact that residents, come January, can sue governments for not doing enough to get homeless persons off the streets or out of public spaces, right?
Right. And this is something that Ron Book, chairman of the Homeless Trust, has said he's very scared about, because what is likely to happen, unless something dramatically changes, is say you have an apartment or a business in downtown Miami and there's homeless residents that sleep in the vicinity. Well, come January 1st, you can actually sue the city of Miami and say, hey, they're not taking care of this problem of people sleeping on the streets. Give me money and damages. And it could amount to millions of dollars. I mean, there's no cap on it.
And that could drain local coffers of funds needed to build more shelter and housing for homeless persons, the lack of which is at the core of the problem in the first place, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of overlapping and intertwining problems that are at play with this. And that's a fear, that this could funnel resources from somewhere that's helping this population into just paying off a local business or something that has an issue with seeing them in their vicinity. And then what are you actually solving there?
Right. You're not actually solving the problem of the homeless person being out on the sidewalk in front of your shop.
You're compensating
Yeah.
someone taking issue with it.
Right. Okay. Right. But let's talk then about that more urgent need now as a result of this new state law to create more temporary or permanent housing for people experiencing homelessness. Are we going to see local budgets for aiding homeless people grow now as a result? Will this forcing the local government's hands that's behind all of this theoretically really come to fruition?
You know, we are in budget season, so a lot of local governments are actually having these discussions now. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of municipalities in all of South Florida, and there's dozens of conversations happening. You know, something I will point out is in November, there's ballot referendums in Miami Beach and in Bal Harbour that will basically allow tax. Most cities give tax, some like a 1% tax percent to the homeless trust. Miami Beach has never implemented this, even as they've been complaining about homelessness. So if voters pass it starting in November, the homeless trust is actually going to have a lot more money to use for housing.
That's interesting to know. Thanks for bringing that up. But that brings us back to what you mentioned earlier, this week's news that Miami-Dade County went ahead and bought a hotel in Cutler Bay to house more than 100 elderly homeless persons, help them to transition to more permanent housing, for example. Tell us about that sort of effort that's going on.
Right. So, again, this is the Miami-Dade Homeless Trust. It's financed with taxes on alcoholic drinks and food in most of the Miami-Dade County. And they just made this purchase of La Quinta in Cutler Bay. During COVID, they bought a motel in North Miami where they've permanently been housing people. They have another project close to Chrome Avenue out west where they're trying to settle and close on it. They have a lot of things in the pipeline, but I think the concern is that while it seems like they can house a lot of people, like how long is it going to take to fight all these little political battles of, I don't want it in my neighborhood, do it somewhere else. Well, it has to be done. At the end of the day, it has to be done. It
has to be done, right. Danny Rivera is WLRN's investigative reporter covering Miami-Dade County for us. Danny, thanks as always.
Thanks, Tim.
Still to come, Tua Tagovailoa and this popular but dangerous sport called football. This is a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Just a reminder, you can make your donation to continue to support programs like this by calling 866-247-9576 or on WLRN.org. Miami Dolphins fans held their collective breath last week when, toward the end of a Thursday night game against the Buffalo Bills, quarterback Tua Tagovailoa darted out of the pocket and ran upfield. But rather than take a safe slide, he put his head down and plowed his helmet straight into a defender's chest, as called here by NBC.
Tua steps up, he's going to run for the first down, and takes a shot at the 6-yard line. Hamlin hit him, and Tua down. Picked up the first, split the seam, but pays the price.
The price was Tagovailoa's fourth concussion in 5 years. Under National Football League protocol, he'll miss at least the next 4 games. But a growing chorus is calling on Tagovailoa to call it quits for good and not risk the sort of long-term brain injury that research shows is a real threat to football players, especially NFL veterans. The 26-year-old Tagovailoa says he has no plans to retire, but his concussion crisis has raised anxious debate, not just about his own future, but about the nature of the sport itself and the inescapable reality that no helmet can protect the brain from damaging trauma when the head gets hit the way it does in football. Now, here at WLRN, we're just like a lot of you out there. We're football fans, too, or we have kids or know young people who play football. Some of us, like me, have played the sport ourselves in the past. So joining me here in the studio now are WLRN Dolphins fans Bonnie Berman, Carlton Gillespie, Danny Rivero, and Sergio Bustos. Bonnie, let me start with you. You're a longtime Dolphins fan, but you know someone who's playing football in college right now, for example, right?
That's right. Our own Giselle Reed, who's senior director of marketing here at WLRN, her son is an incredible safety and has just been given a scholarship at Carnegie Mellon.
What sort of thoughts and feelings, though, has Tua Tagovailoa's concussion situation raised for you? Not just about whether Tua should continue playing, but how families like ours here should be thinking about football these days.
I think it's just so important to consider the dangers of football. I remember when I used to do Topical Currents, we had Steve Almond on. He had written a book called an argument against football, mm-hmm. one fan's reluctant manifesto, which talks about this. You can love football, and we love football, but it is a dangerous sport. Mm-hmm. It's a contact sport that the chronic traumatic encephalopathy, it's so common now when we hear about it after the fact. And I'm just glad there's so much more attention being paid to that now.
Yeah, and you say dangerous sport. That was the exact words of Jaylen Waddle, a Miami Dolphins receiver, when he was asked this week about his situation. Carlton Gillespie, big football fan, right?
Yep.
You played in middle school, right?
Yes.
So let's consider this. This season, there are 17 NFL players who played high school football in Miami. That's more than any other city in the country. Broward County has been quite an NFL pipeline, too. You grew up in South Florida, Carlton. You know how deeply popular football is here. How entrenched is it in our culture, for example? But when we consider situations like Tua's, how do we reconcile our love for the sport with the danger the sport presents?
Well, I think it's become the cost of doing business. And you know, Tua Tagovailoa's concussions aside, you know, Bonnie mentioned CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not something that's developed by two or three concussions. It's developed by multiple what they call subconcussive events. Every football player is at risk for something like this. And
because that sort of thing is going on every play.
Every play. And there are people that got concussions last week that weren't Tua Tagovailoa, who weren't in a primetime spot, who are going to suffer with this. And the person that Tua ran into was Damar Hamlin, who suffered a cardiac arrest on the field last year after an opposing player ran into him. So we've kind of accepted it as part of the spectacle, is that the injury card is going to get rolled out. And it's not just brain injuries. You know, there are kids on football fields in high schools all across this country that are getting, you know, neck injuries, back injuries, tearing ligaments, you know, dislocating shoulders. And, you know, they may never get a dollar for playing football. So because it's so ingrained, we almost never stop to reflect until there's a tragedy.
Yeah, and we should point out that, I mean, you know, Tua Tagovailoa is making, $212 million over 4 years. And even if he were to retire tomorrow, his contract makes it, you know, he'll be taken care of, right?
Yeah. But, I mean, at the same time, there's also, like, Hall of Famer Junior Seau, who committed suicide by shooting himself in the chest and saying, you have to study my brain. Something is wrong. So, you know, even the guys that get all of the money and are comfortable and are legends of the game can still experience this kind
of
stuff.
Danny, in response to Tagovailoa's latest concussion, as I mentioned, one of his teammates this week, receiver Jaylen Waddle, came right out and said, quote, "We play a dangerous game, man." Let me ask you the same question as a football fan. How do we resolve the sort of moral question a statement like Waddle's now presents us?
You know, I don't go to church much. it is a moral question at the end of the day. And I think it's something every individual on the player side and us as consumers, people that watch the games, we need to watch it and consider. And then also, you know, football in a lot of communities, it's a social glue. Like, this is something that holds people together. It brings people together. For a lot of especially low-income communities, I mean, a lot of the football players we have that came out of Miami came out of extremely poor backgrounds. I mean, this is something that's seen as a ticket out,
right?
And there, you know, it is a dangerous game. But how can you tell someone that's looking for a ticket out, don't do it, you're going to, you know, harm yourself? There is a risk involved, but there's a risk involved with so much that we do.
A ticket out of more lower income communities especially, which is why, Sergio, as I mentioned, more and more research has come out about the damage the sport's repeated helmet-to-helmet hits can do to the brain. And I will confess that has dampened my own enthusiasm of a fan. And I'm not alone here. Where I live, Palmetto Bay, we used to have a robust Pop Warner football league for kids. Now it's gone because parents there have decided themselves they don't want their kids playing the sport. What does that tell us, Sergio, about how we should think about the sport today?
Yeah, I think it's a very difficult thing because it's part of our culture. And to change something in your culture is difficult. I've been a football fan for more than 50 years. To see myself walk away from the sport, not do it. But then when you have children, and I had two daughters, even playing soccer, I was worried about the ball hitting my kid's head and them suffering an injury. It's a very difficult question to answer.
Right. Well, my thanks again to WLRN's Bonnie Berman, Carlton Gillespie, Danny Rivero, and Sergio Bustos for your insights and thoughts about this. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Tim.
Finally on the roundup. Give my life. Hispanic Heritage Month started this week, and in a presidential election year, that means Republicans and Democrats discovering salsa music, the Hispanic voter outreach cliche. Former President and GOP candidate Donald Trump made a video titled Kamala Kamala, or Kamala Kamala is so bad. It's a salsa swipe at his Democratic opponent, Vice President Kamala Harris. His campaign says it's supposed to point out that, quote, Hispanic Americans have been left behind, end quote, by Harris and President Biden.
La diferencia es que Kamala escucha. Ella escuchó a las familias cuando los bancos corruptos los sacaron de sus casas. Ella se enfrentó a esos bancos y ganó. Kamala escucha.
Meanwhile, Harris's campaign just launched a $3 million Hispanic media effort with salsa-grooved spots like this one titled Mi Voz, or My Voice. Focused on the critical swing state of Pennsylvania, it says Kamala Escucha, or Kamala Listens, to Hispanic families struggling there and around the country with housing and inflation. Harris leads Trump by a wide margin nationally with Hispanics, but it's much tighter here in Florida. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with help from Polly Landis. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening. Gracias. Merci. Obrigado.